Hello, everybody. It is December 22nd. We've been away for a little while in terms of the podcast. We've been on a crazy tear of busyness at the end of the year with required minimum distributions and people wanting to get in before the end of the new year. So it's quieted down significantly. It's the Thursday before Christmas, and there goes the fax machine. It's been going nonstop all day. Hopefully that will end soon. Merry Christmas to all. Happy Hanukkah to all. What else is there?
Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa to those of you out there. And I hope you're enjoying the holidays. Grayson, do you have all your Christmas shopping done for all those lovely ladies at home you have?
Nope.
So you only...
I don't think I'm ever done. I don't think I'm ever going to be done shopping for them.
Now you're
but
going.
But I mean that in a very good way, Scott.
Oh, very good way. I can see that on your face.
No sarcasm or facetiousness or however you say that.
So you're jumping on a plane Saturday morning, going to the frozen tundra that you call the heartland of the USA.
Yeah, most people call it flyover country because nobody really cares. But they just got done with an Arctic blast, and I think it's going to be a little bit warmer while we're there. Hopefully, I'd like for there to be some snow for the girls to play in, but who knows?
Who knows? Well, so you're going to Omaha and then north to Idaho?
No. North.
Or Iowa, I mean.
Yeah,
oops,
those are,
the other
those
eye.
Two are a long way away from each other. No, to Sergeant Bluff, Iowa.
Iowa, gotcha. Which is significantly colder than Omaha, I understand.
For some strange reason, yeah. It's not that far. It's only 100 miles, but it's, yeah, a lot worse.
Gotcha. So you're going to go shopping when you land in the airport?
Yeah, I mean, who knows? You got to pull a rabbit out of a hat every now and then. We'll see what I can do.
Now, are your kids worried that Santa won't show up in Sergeant Bluff,
no,
Iowa?
They're not old enough to have any concept of that. Santa is universal to them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, what do you have for us today? Can you make it a holiday cheer?
Goodness.
Or
happy, happy, joy, joy. Well, I mean, if you're watching the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones, you feel like it's a Merry Christmas, don't you?
So is the Christmas rally over?
I don't know.
Floundered around the last couple of days.
Yeah, it's typically a bullish time of year. But of course, nothing's 100%. But we had such a torrid rally off the limit down lows of election night that I think it's some people taking a little bit off the table in front of the new year.
Now, what do you mean by limit down lows?
So the futures contracts trade overnight. And technically, the cash stock market does too. I mean, you could, if you really needed to find you wanted to sell Coca-Cola stock at midnight, and you really needed to find a buyer, you might be able to do that. But the index, the S&P 500 index futures, well, and the Dow and the Nasdaq, but those futures contracts trade electronically all night. And so, when it was quite apparent that the Donald was winning the election, they were limit offer, meaning they had gone down so far that the exchange would not allow them to go down any further. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And it's strange, you know, all...
But that was just the night of the election?
Correct. And
okay.
We've pretty much gone straight up since then.
Yeah.
It's rather strange. People, after all these years, people have a perspective of the Dow Jones. So consider the Dow Jones down 900 points overnight, election night.
But only down 900 points because they put a stop to it. They won't allow it to go any further.
Correct.
In the overnights.
Correct.
So theoretically, could have been a lot further than that.
Yeah, and you know, you can artificially see where the, depending on how options prices are trading, You know, sometimes you can artificially calculate where the low would be, and there wasn't a whole lot trading below that.
Hmm.
If that makes sense. But anyway, so the big thing to note, and what I want to talk about today, is a rocket launch of interest rates. Now, it's a little bit odd that we're talking about interest rates rocketing with the 10-year at 2.6%, right? I mean, the 10-year Treasury rate, which is the benchmark of one of the big benchmarks of interest rates worldwide, the 10-year interest rate here is 2.6%. And it's funny to talk about that rocketing up to 2.6, because historically that's so crazy low. That's still very low.
What's the all-time low?
That was July, 1.35. Maybe it was June. I think it was July.
So we're talking almost double.
Yeah, so...
Wait till after Christmas, it'll officially be double.
Well, that's kind of my point. Some relief, you know, very much a relief rally in the markets, in the stocks, after the election. Business people feeling more confident. But the interest rate, the bonds, have been hammered. So when bonds go down, interest rates go up. So we have much higher interest rates, not just on the 10-year, but on LIBOR. And the reason I bring up LIBOR is because so many interest payments worldwide are calculated off what LIBOR is doing. So if LIBOR goes much higher, it's going to trigger much higher interest payments for a lot of revolving debt around the world. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it really needs to make your radar. You know, don't want to be Debbie Downer, but if you're talking about, hey, everything's great after the market is straight up, well, you're a little late to the party. So what are the things that are going to derail Trumponomics, everything's great, the stock market rallies to infinity? The speed of the rally in interest rates everyone should take note of. Because when you see interest rates go significantly higher in such a short term, well, it really hasn't filtered through to a lot of the economic data yet. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So housing numbers,
none of us really even feel this rocket launch. 99% of the people out there I talk to have no idea interest rates are higher right now.
Right, right.
So not only has it not hit economic data yet, it hasn't hit anybody. Are CD rates higher? No.
No.
Are mortgage rates higher?
A little bit, but not
double.
No, but, you know, we went from about 3.5 to 4.25 in a very short period of time. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. How does that really flow through to the residential housing market? I think we need to give it a little time. Now, look, if interest rates kind of wane, edge back down from here, I'm not sure that this is a big deal. But keep it on your radar, because if interest rates continue higher, we are going to have some problems. I've made a broken record talking about the debt bubble that we have blown up around the world in sovereign debt, corporate debt, personal debt, all this debt. If interest rates go significantly higher, there will be defaults. Not maybe, not it comes down to arithmetic. There will be defaults, and there will be big defaults. So, some of the benchmark numbers, probably 2.75% on the 10-year. You know, I wouldn't get real worried about the 10-year treasuries if it stays below 2.75%. And to that point...
You're putting a number to it.
Yeah, well, and the reason is some of this is arithmetic on how the leverage gets skewed if interest rates go a lot higher. Some of it's arithmetic. Some of it's a guess.
Well, and some of this may take quite a while to take effect as well, because... typically, bond debt doesn't get paid off. It just gets refinanced upon the end of the term.
Right. And when interest rates are going down for 35 years, that makes for a soft environment.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Soft as in, look, we could just borrow to infinity because I can just refinance it and never pay it off.
Refinance. Yeah.
But now we're switching over to a world where at maturity, at time that the company or entity has to pay the money back, they may be faced with either not being able to qualify for the quote-unquote refinance, the reissuing of new bonds to pay off the old bonds. But they're also going to be in a situation where it certainly is a higher payment they will have to structure into their business. But the 2008 bomb was kind of a personal mortgage version of this. And what movie was it? The Big Short alluded to the next coming of this as the corporate bond world. So required watching for all. The Big Short was a great movie to help wrap your brain around the debt problems that we have and the problems that occur in the debt problems. And I don't know if you're going to bring up cars and auto loans, but that seems to be happening right now as we speak.
Yeah, so auto loans are, you know, upward of $1 trillion. And we're already getting into all-time record repos. So we've got a very serious problem in auto loan debt. We've got a very serious problem in student loan debt. I have no idea what the pin is that pops those bubbles, or if they even really pop or just deflate seriously. I'm not here to tell you that 2.6% on the 10-year treasury is
2.75, you said.
Well, but right now it's 2.6.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not here to tell you that 2.6% is going to ruin all the revolving credit out there.
No.
But, you know, we have to keep this stuff on our radar because I guarantee you we will have huge corporate defaults in 2017. You will have over $100 billion in corporate defaults in 2017. Maybe that triggers a domino effect. Maybe it doesn't. But we have to be alerted to that. Some of the things I wanted to talk about with, you know, the Trumponomics and kind of justifying from 10,000 feet, not really grinding down a lot into the numbers, but justifying from 10,000 feet, the stock market rally and the pro-business sentiment that the Trump victory has really brought out there, which I'm going to start on a positive. The regulatory revamp that is certainly coming is absolutely a positive thing for the American economy. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes.
The EPA, and this is a very contentious subject. I'm not going to get political on it. But the EPA is going to have reduced regulations. The Energy Department is going to have reduced regulations. We're going to see a lot of the Department of Labor regulations reduced. And look, everyone has a different idea on how much regulation we need, how effective government from Washington across 320 million people, how effective that regulation is. So I don't really want to get into that argument, but I would postulate simply wherever that line is that is reasonably drawn of how much regulation we should have, we've crossed it. So reducing regulation is absolutely a positive. Maybe the Donald reduces too much. I'm not going to get into that discussion right now. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's more just, and it's industry by industry, but it certainly regulation forces the consolidation of businesses and ultimately having fewer businesses competing and much larger businesses. The banking industry is a great example of this, going from a system of a ton of small banks, and through regulation and all the issues, the small banks have a harder time competing and keeping up with all the regulations. So consolidation begins, and now we have, what, five banks from
pretty much
hundreds, four banks from hundreds of banks. So from my very limited point of view, when I look at just, again, very broad topic, I can't sit here and say, well, this regulation did this and this regulation did this, but from a broad perspective, the more and more regulation small businesses have to deal with, the more likely they cannot compete with the larger businesses, which then creates that consolidation of every industry. Is that a good way to sum it up, Grayson?
Yeah, and okay. Just, you know, to put the cherry on top, America does need less regulation right now, and the Trump administration is going to bring it. That's a positive thing, without a doubt in my mind, and the market sure agrees with me. Now, another thing, and I got into a discussion when I was doing one of our classes about the fiscal side of this thing. So when we talk about monetary policy, we're talking about the central bank raising and lowering interest rates and doing what they call quantitative easing, which is essentially printing money and buying assets nobody else wants just so their buddies don't have to take a loss on the price of those assets. Does that make sense? That's monetary policy.
Absolutely. QE3, 4, 5, yeah. 7, 8, 12. QE means quantitative easing, and that means the feds are buying bad assets and right. getting them off the books of banks or whatever companies, pension funds,
exactly. Okay. So that's monetary policy. So fiscal policy, do you understand the difference?
Yes.
Okay, good. Fiscal. Well,
fiscal's more on the budgeting side. Yeah, monetary right. policy right. is handing out free money to your cronies, right.
and,
your buddies.
And raising and lowering the discount rate and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so fiscal policy is really how much more is the federal government, you know, generally the federal government, how much more are they spending than they take in tax revenues? So do you know what our budget deficit was in fiscal 2016?
So the budget planned for, I want to say, maybe a half a billion dollars. $500 million?
That's like what Warren Buffett spent on his Christmas party.
Yes, I understand. I thought it was very small. The budget, the results of it.
The $500 billion.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
I missed three zeros.
Don't worry about that.
No big deal.
Million here, trillion there.
I live in China in my mind. Yeah. I just use whiteout and erasers.
There you go. Whatever works. So the budget deficit was $500 billion. Yet somehow what got added to the national debt was $1 trillion. And this
That's
is,
what it was. Yeah,
there
okay.
are some magic off budget items. I mean, it's, come on, let's be serious. It's just accounting, shovel it under the rug so nobody notices. So in essence, the federal government in their fiscal year ends in September, but for the fiscal year, they essentially spent $1 trillion that they don't have, right?
Yes.
So now everybody's all excited. Well, the Donald is going to do more fiscal stimulus and the federal government's going to spend more money that they don't have. And that's great for the economy.
Sure. Why not? Hand out more free money.
And, you know, budget deficits and this kind of thing. So anyway, I got into a discussion with one of our class attendees, and he said, well, you know, if we went to a balanced budget, the economy would absolutely go into a recession. And I just want people, so that's kind of a Keynesian, John Maynard Keynes, that's kind of a Keynesian way to look at the world. Whenever there's an economic downturn, the government needs to spend more money. And then theoretically, when there's a government or when there's an economic boom, the federal government's going to spend a lot less and pull the reins back in and pay off their debt. Which, you know, maybe.
Is this like a 50-year cycle?
Right. Maybe Keynesianism sounds good on paper, but of course in reality the government never pulls back the reins when times are good. And whoever's listening thinking that Clinton had a budget surplus, stop. He didn't. They were still borrowing money from Social Security to get that supposed surplus. So government never is going to, the way our system is organized, the government's never going to pull the reins back when times are good. So it gets into, well, how much of a budget deficit are we going to have? And I want people to look at it a little bit differently, because they seem, in general, Keynesianism seems to believe that fiscal stimulus is just, you know, juicing the economy with free money from somewhere. But wait a second. If the government's spending more money than they have, where did that money come from?
10-year treasuries.
Well, theoretically, well, supposedly, they're borrowing that money, right?
Yes.
Where are they borrowing that money from?
China.
Well, they're borrowing it from a private sector. The Chinese are selling our treasuries now. They're net sellers now, by the
way. Japan.
Okay. Good guess. But they're borrowing it from the private sector.
IBM.
Right. I mean, well, think about that. So the private sector, historically, has proven to be more efficient with resources, with capital, correct? Can we agree on that?
Yes.
The private sector.
Although I know some people that are off that list.
So can we agree that if the fiscal stimulus that is supposed to be just juicing the economy with free resources out of nowhere, if we look at it from that perspective, that they're actually borrowing from the private sector to spend in the public sector, which is much less efficient, is that really just a free stimulus? I mean, we need to think about that. And, you know, really the only other alternative from borrowing that money from the private sector is more QE, more printing money, right?
Well, so helicopter money is different than QE. QE, they're buying supposed assets, even though we all know they're terrible default assets.
Well, right. So my point is, you've got two choices when you're running, as a government, you've got two choices when you're running a deficit. You print more money and risk a currency crisis, or you borrow it from a more efficient public sector to spend it, from a more efficient private sector to spend it publicly. So all this talk about how wonderful a fiscal stimulus from the Trump administration would be, I want people to look at it from a different angle. And on top of that, when you have, and there's a lot of new research about over-indebted governments going further in debt, and you start to see not only diminishing returns from spending more fiscally with larger fiscal deficits, not only do you start getting diminishing returns, you actually get negative returns. And that's what I fear with a government and an economy as indebted as we are, going further in debt. And don't get me wrong, this could absolutely help a specific industry or a specific company that builds bridges getting a bunch of government contracts. Of course, if you happen to own that stock, you're going to get paid. That's great. So don't, I'm talking completely macroeconomically here. I just want people to look at it a little differently than, oh, now we're going to fiscally stimulate, so the economy's going to be great. It's really a bad idea and potentially destructive idea, in my opinion. Does that make sense?
Yes. So, and I don't know if this is going back or continuing the conversation, I still struggle with the concept of our interest rates rising slowly, and I struggle with them rising quickly. Until we see significant inflation. The last time that we saw interest rates jumping, it was because inflation was running rampant. So which comes first, inflation or rising interest rates?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Chicken or the egg? Which one?
That is a true chicken and the egg. You can look at it from different perspectives.
Because my biggest problem when I'm contemplating this whole rising of interest rates is, if interest rates rise without inflation, then everybody's assets are going to plummet in value quickly. With a very easy example, you have a $600,000 house and somebody's coming to buy it and they can get a 3% mortgage. It's much more affordable to buy that $600,000 house with a 3% mortgage versus buying a same $600,000 house with a 6% mortgage.
Right. Now I'll only pay you $450,000.
That's right. And so our assets, especially things like real estate and anything that we take loans out on, assets plummet in value if interest rates rise, consumer interest rates and lending interest rates rise without inflation to balance it out. And that's what makes this road very difficult. And you've looked more into and know more about the late 70s and the first year or two of the 80s, when we really had interest rates skyrocketing. And from what my limited understanding is, it was because they were trying to jump and keep up with inflation. But give me your take on that.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I don't know if you remember Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, he got eviscerated by the media as the defense secretary, but he was actually Nixon's price czar. I mean, his job was to put a ceiling on prices of goods, services, assets. That was basically his job. And I mean, the concept to a lot of supposed free market Americans, the government telling you how much you can charge for whatever it is, to wash your car, whatever it is outrageous. But that was going on in the late 70s, the big problem was a questioning.
I was still in diapers when this happened. That's why I don't know anything about it.
Scott, you'll shortly be back in diapers. It's not going to be that long. So, yeah, I mean, that was a monetary issue. The world was losing faith in the U.S. dollar. Volcker came in and paid everybody for holding the U.S. dollar. And consequently, I mean, we had a real estate bomb in the early 80s when Volcker rocketed interest rates. So, it's a little difficult to answer your question, Scott, when we have the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain at the controls of interest rates. Which comes first, inflation or higher interest rates? I can't answer that question. You follow me? I mean,
it's a difficult
the pricing the pricing of money, interest rates, that control has been taken over by central banks worldwide, by the IMF, by the Bank for International Settlements. I mean, they're controlling the price of money. So, it's whatever they think, to answer your question. And people say, well, the long end of the curve is priced by the market. 10 years ago, maybe. I mean, look at who's buying all the 10-year Japanese government bonds, the JGBs.
What are they at right now?
0.05% on the 10-year.
So would I put my money in to an entity for 10 years at 0.05% interest?
Right.
And that entity is insolvent,
right,
as in further off the deep end from broke.
Right. Right.
They already jumped off that cliff.
Oh, long ago. Right. So would you do that? Of course you wouldn't.
No.
So people that say that long end of the curve is priced by the market, that's not even true anymore. The Bank of Japan is the buyer of those 10 years. So that's not a free market. That's the Bank of Japan buying it. Look at Europe right now, just for an off-the-wall guess. And I mean, the European Central Bank has really turned up the printing press in the last 6 months. What percentage of Eurozone corporate debt do you think the central bank now owns? I mean, that's a big number, right? I mean, you look
Eurozone at Eurozone corporate debt. So basically just company bonds, you're
That's
saying,
right.
that they own.
That's right.
What? Percentage of the entire Eurozone market
yeah.
that...
Yeah. And they've only been buying for a couple... Well, they've only really been buying...
10%.
It's almost 10%.
Wow.
I mean, in just in I mean, they really heated that up.
Okay, so how is there a number for how much the U.S. owns?
You mean the Fed?
Yeah,
how much does the Fed own?
Yeah,
very little, minuscule.
0.05%.
Tiny. Yeah.
So the Eurozone, they own 10% of all public
company
debt.
Isn't that crazy? You know how much? You know that the Bank of Japan is the largest shareholder of the 10 largest companies in Japan. Think about that.
Yeah.
So let's not talk about free markets much anymore, right? I mean, Ed, the whole world is getting monetized. The whole world is getting financialized. So it's just it's a situation where we have to do our best to because we're all turned into speculators to one degree or another. And we just have to do our best and see what governments, central banks, are going to do and try to front run it. I mean, that's really the job, more than crunching debt to equity numbers and you know expense ratios and margins and all that kind of stuff on individual companies. It's pretty difficult. But that even that being said, now I'd throw another curveball in that last statement. The correlation of U.S. stocks has really come apart. So picking individual stocks rather than just picking the market on what is the central bank going to do, that's back in play. That's back in play. So there's going to be a lot more money managers rather than people saying, oh, I'm buying the S&P 500 ETF.
Well, and we talk about that as a philosophy right now. If the whole idea of investing is to buy something cheap and sell it for more than you bought it for, buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
Now, I always had a knack of buying high and selling low when I picked my own stocks because I got the hot tips way after the hot tip was hot anymore. But the basic idea of all investing is buy low, sell high.
Yep.
And I feel like it's completely absurd to be buying these index ETFs, the broad market investing, because whether you're in it now or you're investing in it now, you're in it at the highest levels they've ever been.
Broad market ETFs have reeled in $100 billion, $100 billion in the last month and a half.
So investing is always a decision you are consciously making on a regular basis. And when I look at the concept of just broad market investing right now, the concept of it, again, from 10,000 feet, there's no way I would have all my money in that, much less even 50% of that. I have a hard time, no matter what your age is, the people that made money are the ones that bought low, sold high, waited till things went low again, and then bought low and sold high. They didn't just sit, unless you are the perfect investor that began investing and saving and your budget was perfect from day one in your early 20s, let's say, and you spent less than you made, which we know there's very few people out there like that. You really need to look at things from a 10,000 foot point of view. And so our philosophy right now, which changes with markets, but right now is it's absurd to be investing in broad market investing right now. The specialized investing, the investing with a purpose, as I call it, really needs to be looked at a little more because there are plenty of sectors that are buying low right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you know, Grayson, I don't know if you want to bring up a couple of sectors. You don't need to bring up actual stocks, but what when we talk about specialty investing, what type of things are we talking about?
Well, especially when you're talking about the industrial world, specific stocks in the industrial world have held up amazingly well, even though their business seems to be coming apart. But mining stocks, you know, some of these hard resource companies that have really weathered an enormous storm, and there's going to be There's going to be big defaults coming up in 2017. But I think 2017 for a lot of these companies will be just aftershocks. I think the worst is over, and there's some great assets among the rubble in there.
So things like the physical asset, heavy asset resource type companies. I've seen some agriculture a little bit here and there.
Agriculture.
What about energy?
Energy, absolutely.
Energy. So these are all examples of specialty investing when you're trying to hedge against inflation. Heavy asset companies are great. And so there's obviously a big reason out there to protect yourself against inflation, because in our history, it comes fast and furious. And, you know, you don't have somebody knocking on the door saying, by the way, next year, we're going to have 15% inflation. Nobody's going to tell you it's coming. And we don't know that it will, because everything's so controlled and muted these days. It's hard to imagine waking up to 15, 20, even more inflation in a year in the United States.
We've been talking about the huge conflicting forces of inflation and deflation, and who knows which one's going to win. We've been talking about that for 3 or 4 years. We still don't have the answer. But with the Federal Reserve, and so they raised interest rates since our last podcast, which I guess I should have mentioned when I talked about, the 10-year rate going up higher. But just the overnight rate went to effectively 5/8. But the Fed came out and talked about how much faster they're going to raise rates in 2017. And if anybody's been paying attention, well, you guys said the same thing at the end of 2016, and that really didn't materialize. So I'm not sure how the market really believes what the Fed says now. One thing I can promise you is if a Paul Volcker came in to, if the Donald ends Janet Yellen's term early and puts a Paul Volcker in there, and the guy comes in and normalizes rates, meaning maybe he takes the overnight rate to 4% or something like that, you would see a worldwide deflationary supernova.
And the scariest thing is the world is begging us not to raise interest rates.
Right.
So and it's okay that we're going over a time in your sector, because I don't have a huge amount to talk about, and I'm enjoying this.
I need to make sure people understand, I'm talking about interest rates going, 10-year rate going all the way up to 2.75% maybe. That's still really low, guys. And historically, again, if we tried to normalize interest rates, there would be a worldwide debt supernova. Let me justify that. Call it $250 trillion worth of debt in the world. If you took the interest rate
in the U.S.,
In the whole world, $250 trillion.
No. But if you're talking about interest rates in the U.S., it would affect the world.
Right. So you take interest rates up 1% worldwide, and people have to refi their debt, or some of this is revolving debt or whatever it is. That math is easy, right? That's $2.5 trillion more debt service.
Interest payments.
You take it up 3%. That's $7.5 trillion. So if we tried to normalize interest rates, there would be a default supernova. Did I make that clear? Did I explain that?
The bubble would pop.
Right?
Yes.
So the concept that we're ever going to have normalized interest rates is faulty at best, right?
Mm-hmm.
An instant rocket launch to those would trigger Armageddon. A grind higher to that is I don't know. I mean, that would require
a grind higher. How about a grind higher with lots of QE?
Yeah, I mean, a grind.
That's the path I'm seeing. I mean, that's the only way we're going to end up doing this without, you know.
So take interest rates higher, but buy all the bad debts that nobody else wants.
That's right.
I mean,
isn't that what's kind of happening? Every time we have a problem, what happens?
Well, really, like the European Central Bank, all that QE they're doing right now, that's not an attempt to take bad debt off people's books. I mean, they're buying corporate debt at negative interest rates. They're trying, right. It's insane. They're simply trying to stimulate the economy. Right now, there isn't downside pressure. Well, and then we didn't even talk, Scott, we didn't even talk about the oldest bank in the world is being nationalized by the Italian government. They're insolvent. So they're just going to scoop it onto the public books and keep going. I mean, so we're in a strange dichotomy of deflationary defaults and government's just printing money and handing it out, which should be inflationary. So, I mean, it's a crazy situation out there.
And so capitalism evolves into socialism every time.
Every single time.
Because that's really what ends up happening.
Every single time.
When the government owns all the businesses, isn't that really just socialism? Or even communism at that point.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's such fuzzy lines between socialism, fascism, and communism. I love the way people throw those terms around.
So socialism is good. Communism is bad.
Right. My point is I don't see significantly higher interest rates for extended periods of time.
Unless somehow we see huge inflation, but what you're saying is with the amount of control, central bank control going on out there, it's hard to believe that. Because my biggest, when we look outwardly, internationally, the more we raise our interest rates, the less affordable we are.
Yes.
And to the international world, and if we become unaffordable, who's going to buy our goods?
Well, part of the problem too is the $6 or $7 trillion of worldwide debt that's denominated in U.S. dollars.
Yeah,
about $6 or $7 trillion that doesn't have an American lender or an American borrower. $6 or $7 trillion. Well, denominated in the U.S. dollar that doesn't have an American on either side of it. So that's, who knows exactly how that rolls out, but that could be, again, a potentially deflationary bubble to pop.
Yeah. Well, and I the example I use on that is, okay, let's say $1 trillion of Brazilian debt is denominated in U.S. dollars, and the U.S. dollar is skyrocketing in value versus the Brazilian dollars,
real.
That debt that's $1 trillion, their currency is going down, our currency is going up, is just exploding bigger and bigger and bigger because their value of their currency is so small and our value is so high.
Right.
And as that disparity gets bigger and bigger, so does that mountain of debt that they owe is exploding in a realm of how do I pay this back?
Right.
And so that's the example I have for there's a lot of international debt out there that's denominated in U.S. dollars. And their currencies are falling to the U.S. dollar, and it's making that debt harder and harder to pay off. Forget interest rates. Let's say they're fixed interest rates. It's their currency that's falling versus the U.S. dollar, and their debt's denominated in U.S. dollars. So that's why, whether it's the IMF or just the international community in general, they're all begging us not to raise interest rates. Because of the problems it's causing externally in the international world.
Yes. And as long as we're talking about the external world, one other thing I want to put on any listener's radar is India. Because India has decided to try to make all economic transactions electronic.
Oh, really?
Funny that more than half their population has no access to a computer.
That'll be interesting.
It's a disaster. I mean, it is.
Is that Modi?
Modi. Yeah. I have to in this over the holidays. I plan on spending a lot more time studying this because I can't figure this out. This is the most ridiculous self-sabotage I think I've ever witnessed. You're talking about, by some measures, the third largest economy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it is absolute chaos. They have just taken the two highest denomination of rupee, their currency. They've just taken them out of circulation. If you don't have those deposited by December 31st this year, it's not even money anymore. It is an absolute circus, but it is a surprise along the lines of the path of least resistance. That's how most surprises go. The path of least resistance right now is worldwide central bankers, governments trying to make all economies completely electronic. That's the path of least resistance. This is a huge surprise along that path of least resistance. So, people, we need to watch this. For them to eliminate cash in America is a long road. You look at the numbers, there are just so many transactions go on every single day in this country, especially anything less than $50. So many transactions in cash. But they're going to whittle away at it. They're going to try to make everything electronic.
Whittle away or just wake up and say your currency is no good here?
I don't think that. Again, I have to study what's going on in India more because this is the most ridiculous thing I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, see, I can see it in much more developed countries. India's developed, but there's a huge disparity between the haves and have-nots, and the have-nots have no access to computers, whereas go to Switzerland or Germany or U.S.
Don't call it a developed country. 20% of the children in India, 20% of them are malnourished to the point of stunting their growth.
Yeah.
20%. So I wouldn't really call that a developed country. And removing cash from that is the most absurd thing I've ever witnessed. And so when you look at that, and I've talked about this a little bit on previous podcasts, and I don't want to be the doomsdayer. I just want people to be aware and keep their eyes open. Because if everything goes completely electronic, we've got a problem. That is hugely, hugely detrimental to your economic freedom.
Oh, absolutely. The amount of control that's now centralized in either the banking or the government sector is just a scary and
atrocious
level.
Yeah.
At that point, and to relate that just to common terms and whether we want to call ourselves doomsdayers or whatever, but implementing negative interest rates is very easy when you have everything
electronic. Yeah.
Negative interest rates are essentially a tax. There's so many things about it that becomes a little scarier when everything has to be electronic.
Yeah.
In my world, virtually everything is electronic. I don't really carry cash very often, but the fact that I can have cash and that cash is still available is the difference.
And that's, maybe that's one of the big reasons why America has really gotten a boost since the election versus the rest of the world. I mean, the U.S. dollar's rallied, call it 10%, which is huge for a currency move since the election. Call it 10%. It's about 10%, depending on which other currency you're talking about. But maybe it is resources coming here because people believe that the Donald is more free market.
Well, just got news that some multi-billionaire over in China is moving his entire manufacturing entity
to the United States. He spent over $1 billion or something setting himself up over here.
Yeah.
Because he feels it's going to be better and cheaper for his business to run it here because of land costs being less expensive, because of taxes being much favorable, incentives from states and governments here in the U.S.
Cheaper energy costs.
Although his labor is going to be higher, it's made up for on all the other aspects. And so,
especially if they get a lower regulatory front. So, yeah. But we're kind of jumping around just because I wanted to make the point that maybe the Donald is going to put the brakes on this banks trying to electronalize. I didn't even say that right. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
Banks making everything electronic. Maybe the Donald will put the brakes on that here in America, but where it's going on in the rest of the world, you can see how dangerous it is. You can see how much power that's giving to the central bank. Now they could literally shut off your purchasing power if they wanted to. Think about that. You're in a car wreck that somehow there's litigation going back and forth, and for whatever reason, the wrong kid decides to press the red button on your bank account because you're in a lawsuit. You can't buy anything. You have no purchasing power.
Which they could do that right now to me.
Well, right, but I mean, at least there you see something coming. You have
the recourse
of having cash. If there's no cash in society, that's a huge problem. Think about this one. A super controlling national government that has nationalized medicine. Well, Scott, you can't go buy your cigars with cash anymore. Now you're putting that on a credit card. Oh, Scott, we saw you bought cigars. You don't get health care. Well, okay, you can have health care, but we're going to debit your account a lot of money to give it to you. All these sorts of things. So, again, I don't want to get off on a tangent, a doomsday or tangent. It sure seems like the Donald will be, regulatory-wise, he's going to be more pro-business. So there's some uptrends there. Maybe that's a big reason for the rally in the dollar and all that kind of and in the stock market. But the Donald doesn't have a magic wand, and we've got humongous debt issues. No, they aren't going away.
I thought he got elected because he does have a magic wand.
Nope.
No. All right. Well,
I ruined most of your time.
Well, no, that's fine. I was enjoying the conversation, and it's been a conversation that I think not only you and I have been engaged in, but a lot of clients and attendees of our classes are engaged in, and so.
Can I throw in one other point?
Sure.
You know, and especially when we're talking about purchasing power off the electronic grid, of course, the first thing that comes to most people's mind is gold. Speculators have sold gold, net sellers of gold, the last 28 trading days in a row.
Mm-hmm.
They're sellers. So if you don't own any, now's a real good time to start buying. A lot of the sellers have sold. There may be more sellers that may go down a little bit. I'm not telling anybody.
We always talk about physical gold in the house as a long-term investment. If you're just going to play around with the value, then you're the paper gold person. You know, if you're speculative investing, the mining stocks are great, but if you're really just trying to trade on gold, whether it's the index or otherwise, that's more of a speculative investing. The physical gold, that's the long-term investing. That's just maintaining purchasing power. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that as a allocation of safe investments. And we talk about that in a couple of our classes. I'm not go buy your guns and gold and
live in
your bomb shelter. I am very far from that, but I'm one of those with the blinders on. I have faith. All my money's electronic, and I'm not worried about Uncle or Big Brother or Uncle Sam.
Uncle Donald knowing
about everything that I'm doing. I don't care about the cameras and the intersections. None of that stuff really bothers me. But that being said, you know, we've got a fun
economic experiment going on across the world, and whether you think interest rates will rise or stay flat, it's hard to imagine our U.S. interest rates going much lower than they are in the future. And so it's certainly possible, but the reality is I run into too many people that have this blind faith in the bond market mm-hmm. as their safe investing. And I just have to, even, you know, Grayson, you talk about the bond market and all the problems, but from a fundamental investing standpoint, every time I see a bond mutual fund or individual bonds in somebody's portfolio, I see an investment that makes absolutely no sense. There's a rare occasion where I see a bond that I look at and say, wow, I wish I had that. I would keep that. Don't touch it. Now, the weird thing is we see people with the double E bond still paying 6% mm-hmm. or the, you know, somebody that has an old fixed annuity from 15 years ago or things like that. Those are the type of investments I keep looking at going, wow, I wish I had that, because they're still paying you 4%, 5%, 6%. Bonds, especially corporate and municipal bonds, I look at them, and anything that is investment grade, triple B and above, you could sell it for a premium if it's a good bond, and you look at your actual yield to maturity, and you start realizing the vast majority of what you have is less than a 3% yield to maturity in a lot of the portfolios we see when you own the individual bonds. And I just keep looking at that going, less than 3% with any risk, with any fees, makes no sense to me, period. I don't know why we would have an investment that has a lower than 3% yield to maturity. You know, then you add a management fee on that, then you worry about any form of risk, whether it's interest rates rising or default risk or any of that. I have this kind of barrier where I'm not going to invest in anything that has any risk whatsoever if I'm getting paid less than 3%. And that's where I look at the bond mutual funds that are out there. The price of your bond mutual fund is a function of the value of the portfolio. If interest rates rise, what happens to the value of bonds? Value of bonds go down. If you have a portfolio with 1,000 different bonds in it and interest rates rise, that means every one of those 1,000 bonds went down in value. What do you think is going to happen to the price of that mutual fund? That's where my concerns really lie. And when I see these bond mutual funds with a yield, an interest payment to you that is in the 2-3% range, if not far less than that, as amazing as that sounds, I don't understand why on earth we would ever invest in something like that. As a safe investment, it seems to me there's more risk than reward going on there. You're not getting rewarded for any form of risk. 3%, no fees, no risk, is attainable out there. It is real. 3% with no fees and no risk. Why on earth would I invest in anything that has risk if I'm getting paid less than 3%? Would you agree, Grayson?
Absolutely. It doesn't make any sense. And I really, I've been banging this drum for a while, and the opportunity has not presented itself in the marketplace as of yet. But I'm telling you, there will be a fire sale in corporate debt. There will be a fire sale that a lot of babies get thrown out with the bathwater. There are going to be huge opportunities coming up. Just stay tuned. This is so macroeconomic, you can't expect to know exactly when the opportunities are going to show up. The key is to be prepared when the opportunities are there, so you know what you're looking at. But the point being, you're not the only one who sees this, Scott, and a lot of people are. If there is an aggressive sell-off in a lot of these bond mutual funds, we could easily get to panic. because the liquidity isn't in this market the way it was 10 years ago.
Well, no. The only people that are really investing in junk bonds are these bond mutual funds.
That's right. So you're going to send... Are you?
Well, before you say that, the reason... And I'm not joking. The big institutions that can invest in stocks, like the banks, the insurance companies, the pension funds, they are not allowed. They are regulated out of junk bonds. So they can only buy BBB and above bonds.
Investment grade
bonds, which means the rest of the world that's below BBB is called junk bonds, and the only investors of those are individual buyers and or the hedge funds that are out there, but primarily it's mutual funds.
Right, so if the mutual funds
so
want to sell,
absurd.
Who are they going to sell it to?
Who knows?
Right? They're not. So that's what I'm saying. And so if all this junk debt that you're talking about, there's no marketplace for these people. If there's a heavy sell-off, there's no marketplace for these people to unload this debt. So what are they going to do?
It's a mess.
So they're going to sell all the investment-grade stuff because there are buyers for the investment-grade stuff. And it's going to push the price down to where you can get very, very reasonable low-risk corporate debt at a discount to par. So that's what I'm talking about with the opportunity.
You always like to say, keep your powder dry. Meaning
your powder dry.
We should be very safe right now. The market's never been higher. Take a deep breath. If your money's not invested for a month or two or even a year, you're not missing out on a huge amount right now. If you have the ability to move on opportunities, there can be huge gains. And you know,
right.
I've already seen a couple of these show up, and we're talking within a 5-year maturity, within, you know, a guaranteed, let's just say, a 20% capital gain, meaning you're paying 80 cents for each dollar at maturity, and you're getting a 4%, 5% interest payment in the meantime.
Well,
these are great opportunities that will show up, and I agree. I've seen
it. Yeah, we found one we bought at 90 cents on the dollar that was only 7 months to maturity.
That's fantastic. In 7 months, you've been guaranteed a 10% profit, obviously, as long as they pay it back.
Plus, we got an interest payment.
Plus, we got a half an interest payment, yeah. So
not many of these are showing up because there's still...
Not enough to fill portfolios, that's for sure. So all, you know, all I really wanted to get at was the world of safe investing is completely different when interest rates are rising or even floundering around trying to go up, because we're going to see one of the two things in the future: floundering around, going up and down and up and down, or we're going to I think possibly somewhere in the future see a very fast rise. But it's just so hard for anybody to handle that economically. Our interest rates affect the rest of the world so much that it's so hard for us to see interest rates rise very quickly. So the world of safe investing needs to be taken a look at.
Can I make one more real quick point? When we're talking about this corporate debt and how there will be significant corporate defaults in 2017, I want people to understand the government and the central banks, they can keep interest rates low. They can keep juicing fiscal policy. They can keep the environment favorable for companies that have maturing debt that need to refi. But they cannot make these people pay on their debt. And if they don't have the money, what happens?
Fire sale of their assets and you'll get 20 cents on the dollar. Well, again, I've always been this way. Grayson and I are obsessed with having access to any and all financial instruments, tools, investments out there. And most of you that know us understand that we just don't have the biases that are out there. You know, I'll look at a stock the same way I'll look at a bond, the same way I'll look at a fixed annuity, the same way I'll look at a variable annuity, the same way I'll look at a reverse mortgage. I'll look at all of them and just tell you they're financial tools and they have a purpose. And I cannot stand the part of my industry
that just has their blinders on, and their idea of managing a portfolio is throwing in a whole bunch of mutual funds, and their allocation to safe investing is just blindly throwing you into investments that are 100% tied to interest rates, which are bond portfolios, bond mutual funds, individual bonds. They are 100% tied to interest rates. I'm fine with that as interest rates go down. I'm not okay with that when the only direction we have is floundering around or going up. And those quote-unquote stockbrokers or financial advisors that just think they are doing you a service by throwing a bunch of mutual funds together is absurd to me, and it's what I fight against every single day, and I hope that we get across a very concise reasoning behind the absurdity in our classes. In many of our classes, I discuss the run to safety and why safe investments are needed and how each of those safe investments react to the future markets that we will be in. So it's a very important for you to revisit your idea of safety if you have not. And we're always available for that. Grayson, you're going to be out of town for the next week, basically. I will be in and out of the office all week next week. We'll be in here for a little bit tomorrow, Friday, and then we've got Christmas Eve, Christmas, and then the whole week between Christmas and New Year's. I'll be in and out of the office, but available if anybody needs us. January's already looking very busy. A lot of people delaying appointments and meetings until after the new year just to get through the holidays, which is certainly understandable, which gives me a nice quiet week in the office after Christmas. But then the storm is a-brewing. So hopefully we'll keep doing the podcast. We probably won't have another one this year. And Grayson, safe travels. I don't know if you have any last thoughts or comments or greetings or anything.
Music City Bowl. Go Big Red.
What is a Music City? Is that a toilet bowl? Do you hear a flush when they start?
No. Well, the funny part about that is the Oregon Ducks aren't going to hear anything.
That's right.
They're not invited to a bowl.
That's right.
So everybody root for the Huskers.
Go Big Red. I love that. That's what I was called most of my life. All right. Everyone, enjoy the holidays and hope to see you in the new year. Lots of classes starting the second week of January, and hope to see you there. As always, visit our website, www.sesweb.net. That's Sam Edward Sam Web.net. Or SecureEstateSolutions.com. All right, we'll talk to you soon. I hope to see you. Thank you. Bye-bye.